This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Be Here Now Network guest podcast. This series features talks from a myriad of modern spiritual teachers expanding on how we can all live a life in balance. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, please go to beherenownetwork.com/guest.
Welcome, everyone. Nice to talk to you. Mm-hmm. I thought I would start out with a little poetic definition of the now from one that you may have heard from one of our favorite poets, William Blake. So here's the definition poetically of the now: to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. And that's it. Thanks very much. So, would you like to begin?
That is a beautiful... It's one of my favorite quotes. Uh-huh. And what I like about it is that William Blake, and this is actually not rehearsed, we just met a few minutes ago. I was surprised that you brought this up. But the reason that William Blake wrote poems like this is that he lived about 100 years after Newton had made his clockwork like mechanistic mm-hmm. model in theoretical physics, in mathematics, in which everything seemed to be perfectly explained as a clockwork mm-hmm. in this mathematical formula. And William Blake in England and Goethe in Germany both revolted against that. They hated that and they wanted science to be different. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, scientists did not listen to them. They just went on with their science, and by their own light, 100 years later, they stumbled on quantum mechanics, which unfortunately Blake and Goethe didn't live long enough to see, since they would have really loved it. It brought back the magic in the yes. understanding of matter and nature.
Beautiful. Yes. Yeah. So that, so just getting a feel for it. I know that as we talk, we're going to get a little intellectual and a little, you know, just bringing science and different kind of new terms and definitions from Tibetan Buddhism, but really try to get a feel for what the now is as we begin to define it, as we begin to offer, just as William Blake did, kind of a shift into experientially knowing the now, which is more felt than intellectually known. It's a direct experience from the Tibetan Buddhist point of view. And I'll talk a little about maybe some simple definitions just to clarify what often is talked about as the present moment, the present, and the now. So, you know, we hear as we're trying to be helped by a lot of spiritual, meditative, contemplative wisdom traditions, you know, be in the present moment, or just be more present, or, you know, get out of the past and get out of the future and be more present. But actually the definition in Tibetan Buddhism for the now is the timeless awareness that includes the past, present, and future. So it's that awareness that treats past, present, and future as equal relative times. And there are kind of traps in getting too caught in the past and too caught in the future, but also too caught in the present. So in terms of the present time, yeah? So one of the teachers of Tibetan Buddhism, Gyanpopa, said, don't invite the future, don't pursue the past, let go of the present. Relax right now. So starting to get a feel of that difference, and I'll talk more about kind of the ways that we get trapped in each one, but just then to define the present moment, which we often hear. And I believe that a lot of the people who say that and are actually just using the term present moment the way I'm using the term now. So it's not like anybody who uses present, be in the present moment. They often mean the same thing I'm calling the now. So, but one of the things you learn when you start to meditate is actually that the way that you aren't so solid and so caught in this identification with everything and in this small sense of self is when you start to meditate, you start to notice that actually thoughts, feelings, and sensations are passing moment to moment. So a moment in time is like this. Gone, 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 gone. So there's almost no way that you can actually be in the present moment. It's like sitting at a riverbank, right? And you look at one area where the water is going over the rock. And if you try to be in that moment, is it the river's gone down already? So it's a new moment. There's new water. It may look the same, but it's actually new water going by, yeah? And interestingly, like if you look at the way we perceive in terms of those who know about film or that there's 24 frames per second of still moments, that when you link them together at exactly that speed, it seems like somebody's like this. If it's too fast, too many frames, they look like this. If it's too few frames, it's slow motion. But our mind is taking these moments and experiencing them as a flow of moment-to-moment experience. And then we're aware from this timeless awareness, which is both spacious and pervasive, which is inherent and connected, but is open, not looking from a kind of point of view, using attention, but literally dropped and opened and inclusive and spacious and all at once. And from there, we can be in the now, remembering the past, deciding what we're going to do, writing a shopping list for the future, and then we can deal with the past, remembering what we need to go shopping for, writing it in the present, and deciding when we're going to go for the future, right? So you can have past, present, and future, and there's no problem with past, present, or future if you're not caught in one. So we'll explore a little bit more about what it means to be in the now and how we kind of get caught in these three times and get kind of fixated or small or enmeshed or obsessed or trapped in time. Clock time, psychological time. Yeah? What do you think about that?
Well, if I didn't know anything about Tibetan Buddhism, I would be really surprised. But for a very long time, I've been studying science professionally and various forms of contemplative traditions, actually from the end of high school, really, as a very serious hobby. And it has always struck me that there are so many parallels between science and between contemplation. Not so much between science and religion, because much of what is called religion is dogmatic, it's political, it's a power play, and much of it is very serious and very personal. So the very serious, experiential, personal part, you can say spirituality, you can say contemplation, let me use that word. In both cases, in science as well as in contemplation, the real trick is a suspension of judgment. If you suspend your judgment, then you can be open to discover new ideas, new things, new aspects. It means not believing and not disbelieving. So no superstition, but also no deadening skepticism. Superstition and strong skepticism are equally closing doors. So the challenge is to just try to be open. And in both cases, in science as well as in contemplation, what leads to new insight is not a new idea. New ideas are great, and especially in art and in many art, literature, fashion, design, new ideas are wonderful. But in science and contemplation, the idea is to see what are the old ideas that hold you back. So try to see which ideas are blocking progress. So in both cases, it is not an addition of ideas, but it is a subtraction. Mm-hmm. Would that make sense? Mm.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. That there's a conditioned mind.
Yeah.
The conditioning is creating relative functioning, mm-hmm. but is also blocking the creative mind, mm-hmm. the naturally awake, spontaneous mind that's bigger than mm-hmm. just the information.
As an example, the beginning of modern astronomy with Copernicus, who came up with the notion that maybe the sun is in the center and the earth goes around the sun. It was not the case that in the time of Copernicus, people were wondering, well, in the morning, is the sun rising or is the earth setting? Once you ask that question, well, then you know you have two possibilities. Before Copernicus, in the Middle Ages, it was so obvious that the sun is rising. So you don't ask the question, is that really true or not? But once you start asking the question, then you have a possibility for a new mm-hmm. opening. And it feels very similar to me in your line of business.
Yes. mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. The amazing thing about this kind of contemplative science is, there's so much wisdom now that's available, both from texts that have been translated from around the world and meetings of minds from many cultures. All the wisdom traditions are being met and understood and being dialogued from empiricism, meaning what's true, what works, which part is cultural, religious belief, and which part is what I call part of the human lineage. Right, mm-hmm. which is the human consciousness, which is the part that we can definitely agree on is what is reported by these wise gals and wise guys, which mm-hmm. is basically that there's a well-being, there's a sense of compassion that's natural and it's already installed in us. It's available, it's who we are, it's equally the same in all of us, but as you say, it's covered over by not only ideas and beliefs, but literally patterns of organizing identity and safety. And those patterns, we just keep reorienting because that's what we know, because that's what the culture is supporting. Mm-hmm. And so even when people have glimpses of this amazing freedom and joy and embodied community, you know, they leave a retreat and a day later they're back and snap, they're back in, you know, I'm sure a number of you have had that experience. You're back in the old way and you kind of remember, oh yeah, remember that, you know, whether it's I went on that retreat or I climbed that hill in that beautiful part of nature, and when I got there with my friends, we felt such joy that we had accomplished something and then we let go of the striving and we looked out over the vista. We felt this vastness and we felt, looked at each other and smiled and just felt this sense of complete joy and connection and well-being to everything, and our creative mind started working. And now, 2 days later, oh, when is my next vacation so I can go back to that place? Because that's where it is. And so the question is that where it is? Or is it, is that natural condition which was brought on by conditions of, which helped to support it, mm-hmm. can that be accessed now because it is natural? And that's the kind of pioneer or revolutionary possibility that groups of people now are starting to support each other to kind of continue to wake up and continue to grow up. And my thesis is actually that awakening is the next natural stage of adult human development. And that that is absolutely capable, but there's so much resistance within us that the strongest, sometimes the strongest ego development that led us to be able to consider that is what's preventing us from going beyond it. Because it's kind of got so comfortable and so protective, and there's got to be a kind of letting go. But once you let go into this now that's aware and embodied and interconnected, in which thought then becomes more of a tool, it's a whole new, it's like the difference between, it's like the Copernican revolution. Copernican revolution. Yeah. It's like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, actually, it is very interesting that in Europe, as much as in Asia and other continents, this sense of living presence, this sense of really being in the now, the way you said, was always present in the traditions for those people who were interested to explore that. But somehow between Copernicus and Galileo around that time, changes in Europe happened, which put the really lived, contemplative, experiential part of Christianity in the background. And I think it was a confluence of Protestantism, protesting with good reason against many of the excesses of and the corruption in the Catholic Church at that time, trying to go back and really make it simple, but then also throwing the baby out with the bathwater and really focusing on the spoken word, on the concepts, and often leaving out the lived ritual supported reality. And then with the Reformation came the Contra-Reformation within the Catholic Church, the Jesuits, etc., mm-hmm. who wanted to compete with them and also show that they could be rational and be better than the excesses of the past. And in that climate, science grew. Mm-hmm. And science and humanism, often based on intellectual, rational part of our mind. And all of those together basically created a climate that mysticism was being pushed out. And when we now talk about the word mystic, we think about things which are sort of vague and not very clear, etc. But if you actually go back to the literature of the mystics in the Middle Ages, they always, I often like to say, they always talk about the seven towers of this and 12 rooms in that building, etc. They were the most quantitative people of their time, and they attracted the best minds of their time. So if we look over a period of a few thousand years rather than a few hundred years, every country and every culture has had both the inquisitive tendency to analyze nature as well as our own mind.
Yes. And what would you say in terms of time and space, in terms of what quantum physics and kind of the Big Bang or Einstein and relativity, anything that is kind of would be helpful for us in terms of time that could be said in 3 minutes?
Look, ask these very simple questions, you see. I will talk him about the 12th Bodhisattva level of enlightenment after this speech. Well, I think the really nice aspect of both relativity theory and quantum mechanics is that, as I said in the beginning already, that it has brought back a sense of wonder and a sense of magic, really, in our appreciation of the nature of reality, of the material nature of reality. We started around 1600 by really simplifying things. And it was amazing that we could do that, that Galileo was dropping some balls, did some very simple experiments, and he had this vision that if you make things really simple and you analyze the motion of some simple objects, that you can step by step unravel the riddles of material reality. And by golly, it worked, very surprisingly. Within one century, you had Newton, and then things became more precise. You got electromagnetism. You got theories of gravity being even more refined by Einstein. And then quantum mechanics came, which showed that everything was really not that simple and that you could not start with a classical space and time like a billiard ball type of stage and simple billiard ball players, but that there is entanglement and things are, objects are not just isolated objects. Objects are what they are depending on how you measure them. So, to say it in a very simple way, science is empirical. And empirical means based on experience. And every experience, whether it is a sensory experience or a motor experience, whether I see a glass or I do something and lift or drink from a glass, in all cases, normally we have a subject and an object and an interaction. And what science did 400 years ago is to study only objects, not interactions, not subjects. If different people in different ways handle the same object, whatever is similar between their experience, that is the property of the object. That was very, very radical and very naive. There were other cultures in India and China for thousands of years before 1600. And the wise people in those cultures had realized that this would be a ridiculous thing to do, to separate the objects from the rest, that the world is much more integrated, that the world is much more unified. But somehow the Europeans were naive enough, and it's a very, there are several theories why that is, that's a whole separate evening we can talk about, okay. But they were naive enough to try and isolate the object part. And they really got very far. They got a very deep understanding of the objectifiable part of nature. Mm. But whenever you do something, if you go deep enough, you run into the limits and you discover something new. Mm. That is the beauty of really going into something and really keep going, whatever it is. Even if you have a wrong idea, if you go far enough and you're honest and you persist, you see more about reality because it's the one reality we live in. Mm. Scientific, spirituality, spiritually, contemplative. Mm. So this whole chase of this chasing of objects for 300 years, from 1600 to 1925, suddenly opened a new door of quantum mechanics where the interaction and the object were entangled. You cannot explain the results of quantum mechanics by positing that each object has an internal structure which can be measured by an objective measurement. That sort of model would be called a model of hidden variables. Imagine that each object has some properties, some states inside, which cannot be measured, that they found out very early on. But maybe there are hidden variables inside each object. 50 years after the invention of quantum mechanics, John Bell discovered that the mathematical theory of quantum mechanics can be used to prove that there are no hidden variables. Not only are the variables of reality hidden in the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics, that was discovered in 1925, but 50 years later, half a century later, it was discovered that we can prove that there are no hidden variables, that any set of variables you might guess might be there would be not compatible with the measurements. Hmm. In other words, if two quantum states are entangled, two particles are entangled with each other and they are being measured at very different places, the moment that this is measured, it influences the type of correlations you can measure there. You cannot send signals. There is no causal relation. That would be very strange. Yeah. And that would not be compatible with our classical everyday experience. But the influence of the correlations, if you posit it classically, it has to go much faster than the speed of light. So there are all kinds of things which break down. And the bottom line, the way I would interpret it, is to say, in the invention of quantum mechanics, we realized that between subject, interaction, and object, interaction and objects are entangled. And I think it will be only a matter of time before subject and interaction and object all will be seen to be given together, like all the great wisdom traditions have told us all along, that the notion of a self is just an artificial pulling out of reality, just as the notion of an object is an artificial pulling out of the tapestry of reality. But you can do that to some extent. You can get very far, and then if you continue, reality will show you that where the limits are and how you can go back to a more integrated way. So I think this particular decade is the time that the study of the object and the study of the subject are forced to come together, whether we want it or not.
Yeah.
The rapid progress of neuroscience, which tells us, which is so connected to who we think we are, and the rapid progress of AI and machine learning, artificial subjects, we are now creating artificial subjects, this finally makes science completely empirical. Empirical, not only one-third empirical on the level of objects, but also on the level of subjects and interactions.
Yeah.
So whether we want it or not, we will become colleagues at the end of this decade. So we better prepare
for it. Might as well start now.
Yeah.
That's good, yes. Yeah, so certainly the empiricism, I think, is kind of some of the radical nature of contemplative practitioners who, you know, would be empirical even if they were in their religious context where they were learning, because of this, this means this. But the real contemplatives that were kind of pioneers would just look at it and say, well, what's true and what's real, and do we need that hypothesis of the religious assumption?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly one of the famous quotes of the Dalai Lama in his interesting dialogue with science, as many of you may know, is a scientist said, well, you know, you have this whole contemplative inner science. What if we proved that some of your assumptions were wrong about what you found? And he looked at the person and said, well, then we change our beliefs. And so that kind of possibility of really doing subject science that then connects to object and subject science. And certainly within neuroscience, what they're finding now as they're looking within the brain is that there's a symphony, but no conductor can be found. So there isn't a little mini-me in there pulling levers, and there are parts of ourselves kind of functionally helping, but the sense of being, which you actually have less suffering and you actually more optimally function, is in what probably the closest thing in science is called a flow state. So a flow state, or athletes talk about being in the zone, or musicians, has been studied by a scientist called Csikszentmihalyi, and the flow state is a way of being optimally functioning where you don't refer to thinking about thinking. That you've done 10,000 hours of whatever you're good at, whether it's art or science or rock climbing or sports or knitting or anything, and you enter into this timeless now where you're completely aware of your body, everyone else. It seems like time kind of slows down, or one of my students said, it's like time is soft. There's a feeling that there's an interconnection with everyone and everything. I don't know if you can kind of have an experience of some time or activity. In fact, most people, I think, who do activities for pleasure, whatever, think about what you do for pleasure, whether it's, you know, working out or walking, or you probably enter the flow state as what you probably think of as kind of a symptom or an after effect of what you're doing, but it's probably why you're doing it. Does that make sense? Anyone have a sense of that? That whatever you do for fun or your hobby or your leisure activity, fishing or whatever it might be, running, you get in the zone. So the flow state, you feel like there isn't an ego center. You're not referencing thought. Time slows down. You feel an interconnection with everyone and everything. You feel like you're optimally functioning without secondary worry or judgment, as you mentioned before. You're not in the judge. The judge is gone. You trust. You're in your, almost like your heart mind. You're living from this level of interconnection and trust. And from here, this is an optimal way of functioning. So my theory, since we're using theory, I always think of Monty Python when I say, my theory is that the Brontosaurus is very, 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 very thin at one end, very, very thick in the middle, and very, very thin at the other end. That's my theory. Yes, but Dr. Havisham, that's everyone knows that. Yes, but it's my theory. my theory is that we've all done 10,000 hours of walking, language, talking, relating to other people, whatever work you do. You have all those tasks, functional tasks, as an adult. You've trained your functional 10,000 hours of life tasks. Now, if you shift into the now, the awareness that's embodied in this timeless awake presence, you'll actually be out of the judge. You'll be in this interconnected feeling with everyone else, that you don't feel as judged, and you feel a kind of natural rising of compassion and well-being, and you'll be optimally functioning. You'll actually be able to respond rather than react. So this, you know, so one of the doors is the now into this. The main really quality is a different type of awareness rather than attention or mental judgment and self-referencing, is getting out of that into this kind of awareness-based knowing that's embodied and open-hearted. And that kind of brings you into the now.
I couldn't agree more. See, this doesn't help as a beginning of a collaboration, but I think what we are going to do, and we may as well start now, is to have a dialogue between science and contemplation about these topics, but not by making a bridge, not by saying here is science and here is contemplation and here is a gap, now we're building a bridge. It would be tempting to do that, to wine and dine and to give a talk about the Big Bang starting with light and Genesis starting with light and being very polite and then nodding to each other. These things can be done and they are fun for a while, but the much more interesting thing is to go down into the gap, to go down into the canyon and to look at the roots of science and the roots of contemplation, starting with the suspension of judgment and starting with the empirical method, like where do the religious, contemplative, spiritual stories come from? There are traditions, there are lineages, but there were radical types who went against the stream of their time, who started these lineages in science as well as in contemplation. So that is how we have to begin to see where do we come from and how can we compare the roots. And the problem here is that science is much more limited than contemplation. It has focused on a limited subset of material, measurable, objective things. But the wonderful thing about science is that it is completely shared by anyone on the planet, and anybody can do an experiment and check. The wonderful thing about contemplation is that in a way it is more deep and more encompassing everything, but we have not even begun to get the cultural sharing and integration. I think that will take a few hundred years. In many ways, Buddhism may very well be closest to science in being more abstract-minded and theoretical-minded, besides being very deeply experiential too. But if you... For me, once I got a sense of some training in Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism and other forms of Buddhism, then I began to recognize the core experiences. For so far, in my own modest way, I began to get access to that. I began to recognize it in medieval Christianity when I started reading about it, in Sufism, Hinduism, Taoism. By the time you get a familiarity, you recognize that. But to start a dialogue between science and contemplation, I think we probably have to start at least at the same time, maybe even earlier, between the great experiential contemplative traditions to get a little bit of a shared vocabulary. And that should be easy. If you let the priests and the mullahs and all the political figures talk with each other, then you start wars. But if you bring contemplatives together, they will bow to each other and recognize each other's accomplishment, even without talking. So that should be the easy part. So that, I think, is the program to look at. And in science, you don't have that. If you do physics, and if you solve a simple problem in mechanics, you can either choose a Lagrangian or a Hamiltonian framework. Let's forget about what it means. But it would be inconceivable that you have a Lagrangian church and a Hamiltonian church and that people start arguing with each other or people start killing each other. That would be completely inconceivable. So I'm looking forward to the time that the much deeper contemplative tradition has learned from the new kids on the block, from the physicists, to integrate their different approaches rather than fight about it.
Yes. Yeah, a funny little story is about at a big inter-spiritual, inter-religious conference in India that I went to when I was studying there, thousands of people, a lot of big name people in all these talks. So by the second day, I just kind of was sitting in the back and I was like, you know, kind of everyone's being polite and just talking about kind of the religious aspect. I walk out into the courtyard and kind of all of a sudden I see like there's two or three other people there. And then there's four or five. And then we all get together, and these people became like my best friends. Mm-hmm. And they were all like the contemplative people who had kind of burned out at the same time on the, and all kind of went out for a break and needed a little air. And, you know, we're also from, but interestingly, one Sufi, one Kabbalist, one, you know, one Hindu yogi, one, you know, more Buddhist. And, but it was a great meeting. So this the sense of the now as being held by that we're held in time, psychological time, we're held in clock time, and that the dualistic mind, the identification that's created with this little managing system, keeps orienting and almost creates this feeling of a little identification, almost like it's an entity in your head behind your eyes looking out, right? Like, what's going on? What am I going to do? And it's almost co-opts your body's survival program, which is supposed to, you know, watch out for cars when you cross the street and is supposed to remember to, you know, plan, you know, get some food at the grocery store so you'll have enough in the refrigerator when you get home late at night and you won't have not planned for the future. And so it has to problem solve. But when this sense of not being in the flow creates this little mini me, this it creates a kind of what in Buddhism suffering is often defined as perpetual dissatisfaction. Anyone identify with that? Yeah, we have a few. So that perpetual dissatisfaction is really that little judge or that problem solver on the level of identity. So, you know, there's definitely issues and problems and stuff to be dealt with on the relative level, but there's the secondary, who am I, what am I gonna do, what am I gonna get to satisfy me as a little thought-based looping pattern that keeps trying to get something in time to satisfy it, but there's nothing for it to eat. There's nothing for it to satisfy because it's made of thought. And it thinks it's a real being. It's a real person in there. So when that problem solver or that judging part relaxes, you can almost start to feel the awareness and the nowness. Yeah? So just simply try this simple inquiry and look with awareness. So no big deal. You don't have to close your eyes or anything. Just simply ask yourself this question and then look with awareness. What's here now when there's no problem to solve? So just not looking up to thought, not looking to the past, not anticipating one moment into the future, just dropping, opening, feeling with awareness, what's this that's here, alert, and noticing thoughts, feelings, and sensations coming and going. What's here, what's this like? So just say a quality or phrase out loud. Anyone? Peace. Space. Nothing.
Everything.
Me. Quiet. Contentment. Whole.
Ah.
Ah.
Why?
Why?
Chair.
Chair. Yeah, so just noticing the quality of awareness, not what you're aware of, but the feeling of what's aware. And the feeling of time and thoughts and change just being allowed to happen without needing to get on the train of thought. And just feel what's the feeling of now, of awareness, of being. As moments come and go. Yeah? Anyone else? Another quality or phrase? What's here?
Rest.
Rest.
Breath.
Breath.
Tickle.
Tickle.
Toward what end?
Toward what end? Now. So just not what you're aware of, but what is the awareness like? What is the nowness, the all-at-onceness? Just that turning of awareness to itself, rather than what you're aware of, the breath, what is that awareness that's spacious and pervasive, interconnected, and all at once, nowness in which time, moments coming and going. Anyone? What do you notice? What's here? What's this like? Here. Alive.
Knowingness.
Knowingness itself. Beautiful. Yeah. So that's... So shall we...
May I do one too?
Yes, please.
This is the beginning of a collaboration.
Yes, please.
Let me do something a little bit similar, but then starting with science.
Good.
So imagine that you are a hard-nosed scientist, and this was all a nice game, but now you go back to reality, and there is space and time, there is matter and energy, and that's all there is. Yeah?
Okay, hold on.
Imagine. So you look around, and I see a piece of matter, my body, piece of matter, my brain, piece of matter. And then what? Well, the first step is to realize that even if you are a hard-nosed scientist, then you realize that your awareness, your experience, comes as an emergent property out of your brain. So if I feel and see and am in touch with a piece of matter like this chair, I cannot put a chair in my mind. I cannot put the molecules of the chair in the emergent properties of my brain. Those are different concepts. Every hard-nosed scientist will agree with that. So what I consider to be matter is really my experience. So let us switch from matter to experience. Mm. Now, once you have experience within the field of experience, within this emergent field coming out of the workings of the brain, within my field of experience, there is a subject and an object. A baby has to learn, spend quite a few months to figure out what is the difference between self and other. So in the experience of a baby and a beginning infant, there is a self part and an other part, and they have to be polarized and being taken apart. Mm. I'm still talking like a hard-nosed scientist. Mm. And then we realize, if we go back to that, that even for us adults, the fact that this is me and this is something else, subject and object are emerging properties out of the field of experience. Mm. So what is really the essence of experience? It is the appearance of the self and the appearance of the others. Mm-hmm. So now we are in the third stage of deeper honesty. What we consider normally as matter is more directly experience, and the experience is really most empirically given as appearance, the appearance of subject and object, and we assign the experience to the subject, and we call the world of matter. So if you go from matter to experience to appearance, then what can we say about appearance? And now here I'm crossing over in your territory. If you look at everything as appearance, the only thing we really know is that it is here. Nobody can deny that something appears. Everything else could be an illusion. It could be the past, the future could be an illusion. Everything could be illusionary, or maybe not even there, even less than an illusion. But the appearance of the illusion is what appears here. So the one thing we really can be sure of, each of us, specifically, empirically, is the presence of appearance. So if you now spend a moment to focus on the presence of appearance, letting go of anything else, letting go of all the stories around what appears, if you can just sit with the presence of appearance for half a minute, maybe. And part of the presence of appearance is the clock, which Tim told us to watch, and we are at the very end of what was given to us, so I think we now have to...
The time is now.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.